Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the lawsuit against President Obama that the House just voted to proceed on, even though the GOP's charge of executive overreach concerns the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, a law House Republicans have voted 50 times to repeal. John Woolley, a professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara, and Gerhard Peters, a professor of political science at Citrus College, both of whom direct the American Presidency Project, join us to discuss the constitutionality of executive orders and how few executive orders President Obama has issued compared to his predecessors. Then we will discuss the default by Argentina on its debts that had previously been settled from an earlier default by 93% of Argentina's creditors. But due to a U.S. District Court ruling in favor of a few speculators known as vulture funds who bought the debt at pennies on the dollar and insist on full payment, the deal has unraveled and the entire country has been thrown into economic hardship to satisfy the greed of a couple of Wall Street billionaires. Joining us is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who, along with 100 economists around the world, have sent a letter to the Congress to mitigate the damage to the international financial system from forcing Argentina into a default. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, to speak with Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian, and discuss the sanctions by the US State Department against 24 high-ranking Venezuelan officials, ostensibly for suppressing anti-government protests that took place months ago. We'll discuss the more likely prospect that the sanctions are in response to a hero's welcome afforded a Venezuelan general accused of drug trafficking, who the U.S. hoped to extradite from Aruba until Dutch authorities allowed him to return to Venezuela because of diplomatic immunity. And joining us now is John Woolley, a professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara, who, together with Gerhard Peters, has developed an extensive and award-winning website, the American Presidency Project, at www.presidency.ucsb.edu, widely used by scholars and others interested in the presidency and American political history. And also joining us is Gerhard Peters, who is the co-director of the American Presidency Project at UC Santa Barbara and a professor of political science at Citrus College. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Woolley and Gerhard Peters.
Pleased to be with you.
Pleased to be with you. Thank you.
And beginning with you, Gerhard, the president, before this vote on Wednesday night in the House to proceed with a lawsuit against President Obama, the president said, "They're mad because I'm doing my job," and he urged the Republicans in the House to stop just hating all the time.
Indeed.
It's pretty surreal, isn't it? I mean, what's your sense of this political theater? Is there any historical precedent for it? Obviously, there's not much substance in it, but in terms of history, have you seen anything like this?
Well, apparently this lawsuit is the first of its kind in history. One thing I want to comment on is, you know, regarding executive orders in general, presidential unilateral action, you know, they're perfectly constitutional. You know, the notion of an executive order is not mentioned specifically in the Constitution. It's not one of the president's express powers, but it's one of his inherent powers. You know, a reasonable person, if the president is to go about executing the laws faithfully, he has to be able to order people within the executive branch to do things. And so that's really the source of what an executive order is. And then furthermore, most executive orders, you can see it very clearly in the text, the president is citing what's called delegated powers. And so when the Congress passes a law, they can't micromanage during the legislative process how a law is going to be implemented. And so a lot of discretion is usually given to the executive branch as to how a law should be implemented and executed. And so the president then usually will cite that source of delegated power. And so the notion that the president can go about doing things with the stroke of a pen is perfectly constitutional. And so in a sense, there is a bit of kabuki theater going on in Washington right now.
And John Woolley, what is the actual substance of the lawsuit? What is it that the Republicans in the House are charging that the president has somehow crossed the constitutional line?
Yeah, they have this action is a House resolution, so it's not actually legislation. It's a authorizing action in the House, and it specifically talks about implementation of the Affordable Care Act. It's It's really very clearly targeted on that. And what they seem to be objecting to is the fact that the president has delayed the effective date of the so-called employer mandate, which requires employers of a certain size to provide health insurance to their employees. And the irony of this, of course, is that the Republicans object strenuously to that provision and believe that it should be, like the entire law, be eliminated. But they've focused on this as a case in which they believe the president has failed to faithfully execute the law as he's pledged to do in the Constitution.
So, in other words, the Affordable Care Act that they voted against to repeal about 50 times, they are nevertheless saying that the basis of this lawsuit is that he exceeded his authority in implementing a law that they want to get rid of.
Yeah, they did, and that's exactly right. And you know, the case that this is should really just be seen as a general exercise of politics is that they also object strenuously to the Dodd-Frank Act and the financial reform. And the implementation of Dodd-Frank Act has been repeatedly delayed in most of the regulatory agencies. And I don't see any move on the part of the GOP and the legislature to pass a resolution to authorize the speaker to participate in legislation charging those people with violating their duties to uphold the Constitution. So it's, you know, it's an interesting situation.
I'd say interesting is a bit of a euphemism. But let me ask Gerhard Peters then, since both you gentlemen do the American Presidency Project at www.presidency.ucsb.edu, and you're tracking the record on a number of presidential actions, but in particular, appropriate to this conversation, are the numbers of executive orders that various presidents have signed over the years. So who is the most prolific in terms of executive orders of the presidents?
Yeah, the one who really liked to sort of wield the power of the pen, we'll say, in this sense. Well, Franklin Roosevelt issued the absolute highest number of executive orders at 3,522 throughout his presidency. One of the measures that I like to use is the average per year because, as you know, Franklin Roosevelt was in office for just a little over 12 years, and so he averaged almost 291 executive orders per year throughout his presidency. And so Woodrow Wilson at 225 per year, Herbert Hoover at 242 a year on average.
And where does Obama stack up?
Well, Obama, if we were to sort of draw the line at what we call the modern presidency with Franklin Roosevelt beginning in 1933, President Obama has issued the fewest number of executive orders per year at 33.27.
And George W. Bush, his predecessor.
Yeah, his predecessor is the second least active president in terms of issuing executive orders with 36.38. Actually, it's very interesting. John and I had done some work recently studying the number of executive orders and also a type of unilateral action. It's sort of a form of unilateral action called memoranda. And we've seen the number of executive orders per year decline consistently over the past three, four decades.
Well, but isn't this all in the effort on the part of the president to get things done? I mean, his position is that I have to act as the chief executive simply because the Congress won't act. And political theater aside, don't we have a real example of that just on Thursday where you have the House, just before they go on recess, failed to pass any bill on the current crisis on the border, a crisis which they, by the way, the Republicans, are talking about in terms of it being a dire threat to America. And you've got Governor Perry of Texas putting the National Guard down on the border, and yet they can't pass anything because the Senator Ted Cruz caucused with House Republicans on the Tea Party side and managed to scuttle the bill. So surely that is an example of the very thing that Obama's arguing about.
Oh, and then let me add one thing to this. I'll use the word audacity here. Today, the Republican leadership, basically, after they failed to advance any legislation, calling on the president to actually use unilateral action to solve this crisis on the border. So just wanted to sort of add that in as well.
Well, didn't Boehner warn that no more unilateral action by the president? That's what he said at his news conference following this ridiculous day of a senator basically scuttling a House bill.
Yeah, Ian, it's this debate has become very confused, and people are talking about different things going on, and so this is a point that I think is important for informed observers to pay attention to, is that, in strictly speaking, the count of the number of executive orders isn't an argument that refutes the GOP claim. Right? So the GOP claim is that the Obama administration is abusing executive discretion in its administration of the law. And virtually every action that they are angry and upset about the Obama administration did not come in the form of a document that's labeled an executive order. So observers who sort of look at the count of executive orders are sort of not really looking at where the action is on this thing. But the underlying debate is about whether the kind of use of discretion that Obama has engaged in is somehow sort of an order of magnitude different from what his predecessors did, or is somehow breaking new ground, or is being constitutionally offensive. And that is really a contentious claim. And it's going to be fought out. We've already seen some of this in the courts with this Halbig decision. But we're going to see these things fought out, and it's important to look at the debate from both sides, as I think you're correct to characterize it as political theater. It's familiar political theater. It reminds me a lot of the kind of commentary actually that we used to see under George W. Bush, where the roles were reversed. And Democrats and liberals had a field day talking about George W. Bush's abuse of power, and they may very well have been right, but what that history reminds us is that Obama would have to do some pretty extreme things to be initiating something new that his predecessors haven't already done.
Again, speaking with John Woolley, a professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara, who together with Gerhard Peters has developed an extensive and award-winning website, the American Presidency Project, at www.presidency.ucsb.edu, widely used by scholars and others interested in the presidency and American political history. And also joining us is Gerhard Peters, who is the co-director of the American Presidency Project at UC Santa Barbara and a professor of political science at Citrus College. So to you, Gerhard Peters, John just was talking about the political theater not being a new thing, but it seems to me that aren't we heading into greater heights of political theater here? Because the I word is hanging, isn't it, the impeachment word? It's as though the White House is saying, go ahead and make my day, impeach me. On the other side, John Boehner is saying, we're not talking about impeachment, we're just going to sue you. But there's also been an awful lot of calls from Sarah Palin and Stockman and others to impeach Obama, and of course, and including Senator Imhoff as well. So, is that to say that there'll be more political theater in the months ahead?
Oh, I don't see this ending anytime during Obama's presidency. This lawsuit, I'm not quite sure exactly what why this lawsuit is being presented. It could be done for one of two reasons. Number one, it's sort of, like a garbage can, almost, political scientists would call it, a way to sort of channel the energy of some of the more Tea Party-leaning Republicans who are clamoring for his impeachment, and sort of a way to dump that into the form of a lawsuit, which, frankly, I wonder if the federal courts are even going to even take up the issue, maybe throw it back to the House. Others suggest that the lawsuit is sort of a precursor to impeachment. So one of the things that, we look back at history in 1998, and, we look at the Republicans clamoring for Bill Clinton's impeachment. That actually did quite a bit to rally the Democratic base, and it was one of the few midterm elections in which the president's party actually picked up seats in Congress. And so I think Speaker Boehner, some of the other leaders in the House, are probably very, very well aware of that. And so I see this lawsuit maybe as a mechanism to sort of almost like a lightning rod, in a sense, to channel some of that energy away from impeachment and toward, this, I'll call it a more creative method of sort of jabbing at the president.
But John Woolley, where are the high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the threshold of impeachment? Is there anything? A lot of smoke, but where's the fire?
Yeah, there's not a lot of fire here, and that's what the Republican leadership recognize. And in fact, there's I don't know if you might have seen this, but in today's Wall Street Journal, there's an essay by Karl Rove in which he talks about the discussion of impeachment as being a Democratic ploy, and that the Democrats are out sort of spreading this slander on the Republicans that they're going to think about impeachment because they know they can get political advantage from doing it. And really, when you see a strategist like this accusing the other side of thinking about something that people on his side are actually talking about, is a fascinating and curious moment. I think they know that this didn't play well in the past, the sort of establishment Republicans. They don't want to see this pursued, but they also are dealing with a base that's just really irrationally upset about Obama, and want to do whatever's necessary to, they believe he's destroying the Constitution and the Republic, and he needs to be reined in.
Well, but surely, John Woolley, what Karl Rove sort of has taken on this role as being the sort of almost the teacher in the kindergarten, trying to get these errant Republicans to see some sense and to behave rationally. I mean, most of his advice, even though he couches it in saying that this is what the Democrats want, he's really signaling to them that they're making a huge mistake, isn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely right. And when you see Karl Rove and John Boehner and other Republican leaders line up on the same side, you see what we've seen repeatedly, which is sort of the mainline Republican establishment looking. It's almost remarkable that they look reasonable and non-confrontational, or not irrational at least. And so they're trying to keep their party from pursuing a course of action that's going to backfire on them in the midterm elections. And they know that's a possibility. And the mere fact that they're engaging in this activity is very much, I think, playing to Obama's advantage. Many reports about the fundraising successes of the Democrats that have come on the heels of this this resolution to sue the president.
And Gerhard Peters, do you think that given that the House couldn't even pass a very watered-down immigration bill, and they're the ones that are saying the sky is falling on the border and we've got to do something about it, at the same time they're so dysfunctional they allow Senator Ted Cruz, a freshman senator, to come and interfere with their House business to scuttle this bill. And the president's position is that I have to use executive orders because of this do-nothing Congress. Do you think that this is going to resonate with the Democrats and the president, to basically say,
you know, you got to vote us in November because the system's broken and it's the fault of the Republican House.
Yeah, no, I've actually thought that. I think one of the big differences between 2012 and 1998, the previous midterm election year that I cited, is that back in 1998, the Democratic base was very mobilized by the efforts, to impeach President Clinton, and you had a very, very strong economy at the time. Certainly, this is, as John Woolley mentioned, this is causing. This is resulting in a fundraising success for the Democrats, and I'm sure it will certainly help to mobilize their base. But one of the biggest differences now is that the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, or at least those people who identify as Tea Party members who tend to affect more the Republican Party, they're equally as mobilized. And also, to sort of get back to something John said, and a lot of it simply is based on their loathing, their hate for the president. And so whether or not this is going to result in any sort of electoral success for the Democrats, you know, the very remote chance that they could take control of the House, that's probably not going to happen, largely because of gerrymandering. And I'm not sure that this will be enough to keep the Democrats from losing the Senate. That's a distinct possibility, because so many of those Democratic incumbents come from Republican-leaning states, and that doesn't bode well for the Democrats this year, no matter how mobilized they are.
And apparently the immigration issue, it plays against Democrats in some of these important states like Arkansas, where there's incumbents, Democratic incumbent senators threatened.
Certainly it does. I'm thinking of states like Louisiana as well. Yeah, definitely.
So just in closing then, I'll just go to John Woolley for a last comment here. Do you think short of impeachment, is there anything that's going to inspire the Democrats to show up? Because it's all about turnout. The president's made that clear. He even went so far as to say that the Democrats have a genetic problem, that they don't show up in midterms.
Yeah, the Democrats are going to play cards that they think are going to mobilize their base. They're going to talk about abortion rights, and they're going to talk about immigration. And there's every sign that the Republicans are going to talk about the same things. And so we're going to have a sort of mobilization contest.
Well, John Woolley, I thank you very much for joining us, and also Gerhard Peters.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Woolley, who's a professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara, who, together with Gerhard Peters, has developed an extensive and award-winning website, the American Presidency Project, at www.presidency.ucsb.edu, widely used by scholars and others interested in the presidency and American political history. And also joining us was Gerhard Peters, who is the co-director of the American Presidency Project at UC Santa Barbara and a professor of political science at Citrus College. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how a few vulture funds forced Argentina into default. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Weisbrot, who's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and president of Just Foreign Policy. He has an article at U.S. News & World Report, Who Shot Argentina?, and is among 100 other prominent economists from around the world who have just signed a letter urging the U.S. Congress to mitigate the damage to the international financial system brought by a New York district court's judge's recent ruling that forces Argentina into a default to satisfy the demands of a small minority of so-called vulture funds. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
And this deal that's just unraveled, where Argentina defaulted some time back, 93% of the creditors agreed to take a haircut, and but a small minority of holdouts managed to get to sue and get a ruling from a U.S. district court in New York to basically undo this whole deal just to satisfy the demands from these vulture funds who bought the debt for penny on the dollars and are now insisting on full payment. Is that an accurate description of where we have been?
Yes, I think so. It's a little worse than that. I mean, first, you know, a lot of the press refers to these creditors as holdouts, but the people with the that organized the lawsuit, the plaintiffs are really not the holdouts. They are, as you said, people who bought the debt after Argentina defaulted. So they're not people who just didn't want to take the deal, the restructuring deal in 2005 or 2010. In other words, they bought the debt after the default with the hope of doing exactly this. This is why they're called vulture funds. It's not really just a pejorative. It's what they do. And so they came in to get this and to sue. And, you know, it would be one thing if the Judge Griesa from the district court that you mentioned, the New York court, for the federal court for the Southern District of New York, if he had just said, okay, to Argentina, you have to pay the vultures, that would have been one thing. And I don't think you would see so much controversy. But instead, he took the other 93% of bondholders hostage and said, you can't pay them. And so here is Argentina, which is technically in default, although they never really defaulted. They gave the money to the New York bank for payment to these creditors, and it's actually the court that's defaulting for them by ordering the New York banking system, and including the bank who has the $500 million of interest payments that was due this month, to ordering them not to actually make the payment. So Argentina's not in default. 93% of the creditors didn't want to, you know, have accepted this deal, and they've received payment on time consistently since 2005. And yet the court is not allowing the payment to go through. That's what's really unprecedented and is really bad law and bad economics.
Well, my understanding, though, is that this case that the Argentinian government wanted to take it to the Supreme Court after a ruling by this judge, and that the Supreme Court refused to hear it, so it bounced back and therefore became the law. And there have been articles about Judge Griesa simply not understanding the issues at hand, let alone the consequences of his ruling.
No, that's right. Floyd Norris had a piece in the New York Times just about a week ago showing that the judge, after all this time, which is years already, had been dealing with this case, I think, for 10 years, still didn't have a grasp on who was affected by his judgment, like not even a basic idea of who all the bondholders, foreign bondholders were, what currency or they were in, what laws they were under, and who would be affected by what. And so this is what this, you know, if you have a Supreme, the purpose of having a Supreme Court is when a lower court makes an incompetent decision that the Supreme Court is there to review it, and they didn't do it. And that, to me, I think should get more criticism, because that's really an abdication of their judicial responsibility.
So the fact that the financial markets went into a tailspin on Thursday after Argentina defaulted on its debt, which was, as we've made clear, they were essentially forced into by these minority of vulture funds and the ruling in their favor by this court, do you think that got the judge's attention? I mean, it certainly got Wall Street's attention.
It's hard to say. I mean, he's definitely an outlier. I can't really say what motivates him to
again, take this unusual, unprecedented step of holding, the vast majority of creditors hostage to a small group. A group who, by the way, was offered a pretty good deal from Argentina. I mean, the government offered them a deal that would have given them a 300% return over the 6 years that they, since they bought the debt. And they rejected that.
And mostly this is a fellow called Paul Singer, right? He seems to be the main protagonist.
Yes, he is in this case, and his firm, NML Capital.
And he's been doing this kind of thing for a while, has he not, in the Congo and other places?
Yes, going back to the 90s in a number of different, in a number of other countries. So, but I think the court is really the main problem here, because they just never should have done anything like this. And as I said, there's no precedent for it. And it's punishing people who, I mean, what did the bondholders who agreed to the restructuring do wrong? And again, in terms of the responsibility of the Supreme Court, this is not just a bad legal decision, of which there are many, and the court can't review them all. This is one that has quite enormous consequences, not only for Argentina, but for the whole international financial system. You have the problem, the basic problem is that sovereign borrowers, countries, and governments that borrow, there's no bankruptcy mechanism for them. They can't declare bankruptcy and start over like individuals and corporations can in the United States. And there's no mechanism for the debt to be worked out in an orderly manner. So you have to, these are done through restructuring agreements. It took years of negotiation to get this one. And what happened now is that for bonds that are at least written under U.S. law, this is going to be extremely difficult, because any one bondholder can scuttle the whole thing and has quite a big incentive to do so now because of this ruling. So again, the Supreme Court should have known that this had enormous consequences. It's going to make it difficult. I mean, you're going to have more defaults and restructuring. This is not, especially looking forward, when the Fed eventually starts to raise interest rates and pulls money out of emerging markets, there are going to be problems, as there have in the past. And what are they going to do? Everything is going to be much more difficult if this decision holds. Now, from the point of view of looking at it from the judge's own area, New York area, I mean, this is Wall Street and the financial industry, and there's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of emerging market bonds, and a lot of them are going to go elsewhere to a more reliable judicial system.
So let's talk about this letter that you and over 100 other economists, including Nobel laureate Robert Solow, have written to the Congress. Essentially, what do you expect from this Congress, which, needless to say, is pretty dysfunctional?
Yes, well, we don't expect anything right away. But this is a long-term problem, and the Congress can fix this in a number of ways. I mean, one is they can amend the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act so that it does what it's supposed to do, that is, protect against exactly this kind of thing, this kind of outcome, where a sovereign debtor is subjected to this kind of a decision. So they could do that. There's other legislative changes they can make to actually prevent these things from happening in the future. I mean, it is also, arguably unconstitutional because the court is taking from these other creditors who had, nothing to do with this lawsuit and didn't do anything that justifies taking their property, which the court has done right now by forcing the bank, the New York bank, not to distribute their interest payments. So there's any number of legislative remedies for this. And there's also, this isn't the Congress, but the Argentina could potentially file an action under the WTO as well, because it prohibits this kind of blocking of the transfer of payments.
But it just seems to me, though, so deeply unfair that this country of Argentina, what, of 40-something million people, that has already gone through economic hardship because this default happened some time back, they're barely getting their economy back together, and now this whole deal has unraveled, and essentially an entire nation is being punished because of the greed of a couple of billionaires on Wall Street who turned down a 300% return on buying this debt after the default for pennies on the dollar. And they weren't even subject to the original default. They weren't even the creditors. They were just literally vultures who went in to pick the bones.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, that's the horrible thing from the point of view of economic justice, and it's going to, again, it'll affect other countries, even poorer countries than Argentina. And Argentina really didn't have any choice. And they defaulted at the end of 2001. And at that time, they had already gone through 4 years of recession, trying to maintain their deal. It was really a depression, actually. The loss of output was comparable to the Great Depression in the United States from, like, 1929 to 33. And they had, you know, they had suffered a lot. The unemployment was 22%. More than around half the country had fallen below the poverty line in a country that was really had about the highest living standards in Latin America. And this all happened in about 4 years. And then they defaulted on their debt because they really had no choice. And then the IMF tried to squeeze them to pay more to the creditors and tried to force them to adopt the traditional austerity. And the economy shrank for about 3 months after the default, and they devalued shortly after they defaulted. They had a problem similar to the Eurozone where they had their currency was pegged to the dollar and it wasn't sustainable. And so then they shrank for one quarter, and then they recovered. And they recovered very quickly after that, of those 3 months. And this went on they've done very well, actually, between 2002 and today. They had very high growth. By 2011, they had cut poverty by 70%, and they had achieved record levels of employment. So it was very successful, and it couldn't have been done without this debt restructuring. They could have dragged them along. I mean, compared to Greece, for example, that's what they're doing in Greece, is 6 years of recession. They're dragging it out. They've got a debt of 169% of GDP, which is still probably not going to be payable. They've got 26% unemployment, and twice that for you. That was the alternative for Argentina, really, to defaulting, was to go through this process for years and years of stagnation and really high unemployment. And then, of course, Greece isn't over yet, too. You know, they might still have to have another restructuring.
Well, Mark Weisbrot, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot, who's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and president of Just Foreign Policy. He has an article at U.S. News & World Report, Who Shot Argentina?, and is among 100 other prominent economists from around the world who have just signed a letter urging the U.S. Congress to mitigate the damage to the international financial system brought by a New York District Court's recent ruling that forces Argentina into a default to satisfy the demands of a small minority of vulture funds. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Caracas, Venezuela.
Es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra. El pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Virginia Lopez, who is a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, thanks. And there seems to be a consensus that, at least amongst Latin American observers here in the United States, that the State Department's travel ban on 24 high-ranking Venezuelan officials is likely to backfire and, in fact, play right into the hands of President Nicolas Maduro's government, who have for the longest time been blaming America for just about everything.
Well, it was the reason why it took so long to pass the ban. There had been concerns that, like you've just said, that the Venezuelan government would use the sort of meddling by the U.S., as they would say, to excuse basically anything from economic woes to just about anything.
And, of course, the ban has not named who's blacklisted, because apparently these visa records are confidential, and all that the State Department will say is that the list includes cabinet members, presidential advisors, police, and military officials. Do you have any idea who might be on the list?
Well, again, you know, there was a lot of rumors flying around when this idea was first considered, or I guess about 3 months ago, that it would be very high-ranking officials. Anything, I think it might have even included the head of the National Assembly. I'm not exactly sure right now. But basically, when the idea of banning officials came around, it was as a move to protest abuse of power during the clashes that erupted in Caracas and in other cities, I guess, over 4 months ago now.
Well, that's what's so peculiar about them, is that these protests have subsided, have they not? So I take it then the assumption must be that, one, President Obama is acting because of pressure from Congress, but two, could this be retaliation by the U.S. over what happened recently with Aruba, where Venezuelan General Hugo Carvajal, who's accused of trafficking thousands of pounds of cocaine to the U.S., he was appointed as Venezuela's consul in Aruba. The U.S. then pressured the Arubans to arrest him, and then the Dutch then in turn pressured the Arubans to let him go on the basis that even though he hadn't actually formally become the consul general, that it was nevertheless a violation of the International Convention on protecting diplomats. So what's the sense in Venezuela? Do people think that the U.S. is just mad that the general kind of got away?
Yes, very much so. There's been very strong statements from U.S. officials on how unacceptable they found the move to release Carvajal and basically return him to what was considered a sort of a hero's welcome here in Venezuela. But the sense is also that because these clashes have been, you know, they ended close to a month ago, it's also that the U.S. seems to no longer really sort of care about what the public opinion is, and they're just sort of going, escalating their diplomatic measures against, you know, government officials, so to speak.
So is that to say then that the opposition in Venezuela does not feel that the U.S. is supporting them anymore? Because the charge has always been from Maduro and from Chavez before him that the opposition in Venezuela are all tools of the Yankee imperialists. So is there a sense now that the U.S. doesn't care?
The opposition, curiously enough, has had actually basically absolutely nothing to say on the Carvajal affair after he was returned as a, like I said, on Sunday night, so, you know, to the surprise of everyone here. It's just basically like garnered no reaction whatsoever amongst them. This could be because the opposition itself was going through a series of sort of soul-seeking meetings, and in fact, one of their main leaders resigned as leader of the dialogue table, or the unity table, I should say. But, you know, I don't know if it's because it's so delicate or if because they just consider that it's a better move to just not issue an opinion on either U.S. involvement, because, again, like you said, it tends to backfire, or also because, you know, Carvajal is a high-ranking Chavista official and they've just decided that, you know, it's just not something that they'll want to get into.
So in terms of drug trafficking as an issue, obviously you would be politically dead in most countries in the world if you're accused of trafficking tons of cocaine. The fact that this guy was given a hero's welcome, is anybody looking into the possibility that there may be some truth to these charges?
Again, you know, nothing has been said. Other than, you know, Maduro called it an illegal kidnapping, President Maduro. And again, you know, when the capture first occurred, he said that we, you know, he himself would stop at nothing to rescue or to recover Carvajal. So from the very beginning, from very high up in the government, there was a sort of move to deny the charges, probably not explicitly, but certainly, you know, in their actions. I think that it's also worth noting that in 2008, the U.S. Treasury basically put in their blacklisted three government officials, one of them being Hugo Carvajal, and the other two are currently serving as governors of two states in Venezuela. So, you know, It, like I said, there seems to be an implicit denial of these charges, but not a sort of explicit denial that this has ever occurred.
And in 2008, the U.S. Treasury accused these three officials of materially assisting the narcotics trafficking activities of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC. So is the fact that the demonstrations against the Maduro government have subsided and that the opposition is silent, is that to do with the fact that now in Venezuela, the Chavistas and the Maduro government have basically control all of the media now? It's sort of like Putin's Russia, really, where there's virtually no opposition media left. The last major newspaper that was an opposition newspaper apparently has been bought out by cronies of Maduro, and Globo Television, the last opposition television network was bought out 6 months ago, I think. But the newspaper was bought out relatively recently. Is that how it is in Venezuela now, that there really isn't any opposition voice in the media?
There's a decreasing number of opposition voices. In fact, the country's biggest daily, which was just recently bought, like you said, just did sort of a clean swipe of all of their editorial, but all of their opinion commentators. So yes, you know, there's...
You mean they fired them all? They fired them all?
Yes, and also a comedian had his show pulled out of the TV, sort of his late night TV show, out of the station after he did some sort of sketch mocking government accusations of, you know, yet another magnicide. So yes, you know, I think that's probably got to do with the fact that there's no outlet, or basically very few outlets left for opposition or any dissent to be voiced.
So, but are conditions in the country still the same, the very conditions that led to all of these street protests, the lack of staples like toilet paper, the lack of security for ordinary citizens, the enormous high murder rate, robbery rate, etc. Do those conditions still operate?
I would dare to say that the general sense is that they've actually gotten worse. You know, I mean, certainly there's been no economic measures taken as of yet to correct inflation or to increase productivity or to lift price controls. There certainly seems, you know, crime seems to still be an issue and one that sort of hasn't necessarily decreased. And food shortages, of course, you know, that was sort of at the crux of all of the discontent are still, it's everything. It's not just food shortages. It's anything from caskets to bury the dead. It's spare parts to fix cars or even heavy machinery. And things as extreme as like radioactive isotopes to diagnose cancer. There's like I said, there's just an increase of not only shortages of food, but of even more so, you know, every day there's just something that goes missing.
But how long can the government then blame all of these shortages on foreign interference from these people in Miami that they continue to say are plotting and trying to destabilize the government of Hugo Chavez's successor? At what point do they have to take responsibility?
I don't think I have an answer for that. I mean, I would imagine that their timeline is somehow, you know, running short. And there's certainly mounting criticism from within their own ranks. The ousting of a minister led to him writing a sort of open letter criticizing some of the measures that the government had taken. And, of course, the government sort of promptly retaliated by expelling him from the party and expelling someone who sided with him, another government official, from the party as well. So, you know, there's growing concern nationwide. This isn't just the opposition now voicing their dissent on these economic measures or political decisions. But they're still standing. I assume that a fractured opposition doesn't help. And of course, like you say, you know, they control a lot of the media, they control the judicial power, they control basically, you know, most of the country's institutions.
So is there any sense then of where Maduro stands in terms of being more authoritarian? Because it seemed to me that Hugo Chavez was obviously incredibly popular, but he nevertheless didn't really, he tolerated the opposition press, did he not? I mean, is his successor, does he have more authoritarian impulses than Chavez had?
I think a lot of these decisions to buy media outlets, for example, were decisions that were taken during the Chavez years, and it's just basically taken some time to implement. A lot of the, for example, a lot of the print media went under a lot of sort of economic pressure because there was no paper available to print. The you know dailies. So you know it's sort of a combination and a rather sort of clever way of minimizing your enemy by just debilitating sort of you know what makes him sustainable economically. Similarly, with the TV channel, there were so many lawsuits against the TV channel for transmitting you know anything that was deemed subversive or, you know, in any way critical was sort of escalated to be considered subversive, that it slowly eroded the feasibility of having a channel. And so sort of the owner, you know, was, I don't know, forced, but certainly, you know, offered an attractive paycheck and decided to take it, no? So I don't think Maduro is sort of the mastermind behind these decisions. I think he's just sort of following in the steps of his mentor, and it's just gotten to the point where he's now being able to sort of give the final stroke.
But, of course, the supporters of the Chavez and Maduro, his successor, in the West always argued that Venezuela for the longest time was run by oligarchs who didn't give a damn about the people and bled the country dry and took all the oil revenues for themselves, and that since the revolution there's been the poor have the lives of the poor and the majority of the people in the country have improved. So can you give us a sense then of whether or not, you know, it's not just the elite that have fled, but Is this eating into the middle class, this lack of economic stability, lack of currency, lack of international travel, lack of staples, extraordinary crime rate, the worst in the world, I think, or at least in the hemisphere? So when you talk about, when I mentioned professionals and business people leaving, we're not talking about the elite, are we? They've left long ago.
No, of course not. Yeah. No, Venezuela was made up of a lot of immigrants that fled, you know, countries like Spain, Portugal, and Italy after the World War, you know, Second World War. This is a lot of their descendants who have, you know, dual nationality and can legally move. But, you know, but I'm hardly talking about the elite, you know. In fact, some groups in the elite have sided with the government and are even richer now. That's sort of some of the contradictions that Chavez supporters have criticized of Chavismo. And it was certainly one of the issues that was raised during the recent sort of party congress that the Chavistas held. Like I said, this minister that resigned, Giordani, one of his biggest criticisms was corruption amongst Chavista flanks. We're talking about close to $20 billion in one or two years related to granting preferential dollars because of the exchange control. So these controls have just bred more and more distortions and you know, more and more corruption. This is something, like I said, that even Chavistas recognize, you know, and that are critical of what's going on. But the crisis is hitting everybody across the board, you know. I mean, the statistics talk about, you know, the biggest victims of crime being poor men between the ages of, you know, 18 and 24. We're, you know, the largest number of victims of this sort of epidemic of crime are not the elite. It's basically, like I said, it's young men who live in shanty towns and for some reason seem to be heavily armed. That's with regards to crime. With regards to shortages, like I said, it's anything from spare car parts to toilet paper. You know, I mean, I don't want to get too graphic about who's affected by a shortage of toilet paper, but I assume it's a universal need. So no, this isn't a matter of the elite fleeing the revolution. I think everybody at this point is feeling the strain of an economy in dire straits, you know, despite an oil barrel at $100, you know, and
sure. There's
probably, you know, record-breaking prices in Venezuela's history.
Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who is a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and for Sky TV. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Whoa.